The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Farmers report a rise in the number of dog attacks. The fog of war, how Russia is waging its propaganda campaign.
The question with these things is never, would it be nice? It would be nice. The question is, would it be nice enough to justify the extraordinary cost?
Concerns over the detailed planning of the Metrolink has aired at the oral hearing. The Small Claims Court does what it says on the tin, but does it need a makeover?
We can have the hairdo that went wrong, the dating agency that didn't deliver. We've even had a case against a dog groomer for a grooming that was deemed or considered to be not fit for purpose.
If you're a horsey type in Finland, Cheltenham pales in comparison to the hobby horse races. How the arts are good for your health.
The arts are not about curing anything. The arts don't cure cancer. The arts heal, which is different.
Learning to live the net zero life, and the cash machine contains €10,831.51. Text us on 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. WhatsApp free 087-1400-106. Email patkenny@newstalk.com. You can tweet us at patkennynt. But first, as you've been hearing, the Joint Committee on Assisted Dying is going to publish its report on the 20th of March, and it's set to recommend that legislation be brought in to allow for assisted dying for someone with a terminal illness who is suffering. Now, to talk about this, we are joined by Dr. Andrea Mulligan, Assistant Professor of Law at Trinity College in Dublin and a practicing barrister, and Dr. Miriam Colleran, Consultant in Palliative Medicine. Good morning and welcome to you both. Andrea, I'll go to you first, if you can tease out for us the recommendations that are going to be brought in.
Good morning, Pat. So the first thing I would say is that what we have at the moment is an indication of the big principle decisions the committee is going to recommend. We don't have the detail. So I suppose we're awaiting that, and presumably that will be available in the report on the 20th of March. But the key recommendations that they've made is that they're going to recommend the bringing in of legislation to allow for assisted dying. And the criteria in which they're going to recommend that is that if a person has a terminal illness and has a short time to live, and it appears that that's going to be between 6 and 12 months to live, and also a suffering criterion, which would require that the person be suffering from sort of pain and suffering that cannot be relieved in a way that the person finds tolerable. So essentially both a terminality criterion and a suffering criterion.
Now, one person's pain might not be another person's pain. There are some people who are very stoic in the face of pain, and then other people who find even moderate pain intolerable. So it will depend on the patient's own, I suppose, reporting of their pain.
Mm-hmm. It will. And I think one thing that's interesting about the decision they've made is that some regimes have no terminality requirement and just a suffering requirement. So essentially, just a fairly subjective criterion, whereas what they appear to be recommending is both an objective terminality requirement and a suffering requirement. So the suffering has to involve some degree of subjectivity. The terminality must be objective.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at an illness that is deemed to be terminal a year out, I mean, some people will say, well, he or she died a year to the day after they got that prognosis. Other people will say, well, John or Mary defied that prognosis and lived on for several years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suspect that the response from the medical community may point exactly to that fact, that I think doctors very fairly don't like to be pinned down to specific time frames because it's not an exact science. So I think it would be interesting to hear what the medical community has to say about that, you know, strict time criterion.
The question of people not being able to articulate their own wishes through disability, dementia and so on, is that going to be some sort of a twilight zone where any compassionate person looking at their suffering might say, oh, this is terrible. This poor individual hanging on in there because that's what the life force does. But really, it's a terrible life they have. Pain relief, hydration, starvation, perhaps, you know, all of those things. And it might seem cruel, but they can't articulate a wish.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that is the case. I expect what their committee will recommend will be essentially leaving that person in that twilight zone, because the alternative is a situation whereby one person can decide to actively end the life of another without their consent and their voluntary will. So I expect that this report and then any legislation flowing from it will not address that.
Now, the committee obviously is making principled declarations as to what they would like to see happening. I'm not sure how much detail they would recommend in terms of the writing of legislation. But I would suspect that there would be some paragraphs in there somewhere about a living will and the wishes as indicated by a person.
Absolutely. And some jurisdictions will allow essentially an advance directive whereby you can say that if you reach a certain stage of incapacity, the condition you were talking about a moment ago, that at that stage you would like to avail of assisted dying and bind yourself into the future. Some regimes don't allow for that. So we don't know what the committee will recommend on that. And that's another big principled issue. So it'll be very interesting to see whether they cover that at all.
Well, there is already the protocol DNR, do not resuscitate, which people are allowed to indicate. If someone, for example, has had a stroke and they realise that the next one might be utterly catastrophic, they can actually issue an instruction to the medical team, do not resuscitate, do not go to extraordinary means to bring me back when I know what lies ahead, what would not be pleasant.
Mm-hmm. And that's very important. And it's very important that doctors recognise that, that people are entitled to say they don't want extraordinary intervention into the future. But the distinction, I suppose, is between saying you don't want interventions and saying you want to be have your life ended. So you want to be actively killed in the future. And I expect that, that that's an important issue the committee will have had to decide and may or may not have tackled.
One presumes that doctors at the end of the day might be the decision makers in all of this. So the question of one doctor, two doctors, three doctors signing off on this.
I think so. And I think that's going to be a huge issue for the medical profession. Like, presumably they will have to sign off on it. Some doctors, I imagine, will not be comfortable doing that. So probably the issue of conscientious objection will become quite important. Equally, there may be other doctors that see it as part of their ethical role. So I think if this is implemented, it will cause important discussions to be had among the medical community on that.
Now, when I started out in broadcasting, we did not have a contraception regime. We certainly did not have an abortion regime. We did not have a divorce regime here. We have all of those things, but the whole idea of assisted dying seemed to be the last taboo that we might never cross, but here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's important not to see it as kind of inevitable. Like, it's an important decision, and it's very important that Irish society has the sort of maturity to deal with these complex ethical issues. And it's very positive to see that level of detail and nuance, I think, in the debate so far.
I know that people will be saying, why can't we have a referendum on this like we're having? We had it on, of course, the Eighth Amendment, but that was something that was put into the Constitution, then was taken out. So here we have a situation where people would be saying, I want the country to speak on this rather than a committee. What's the problem with having a referendum?
Well, we just don't need to have a referendum. So in the Fleming case where Marie Fleming challenged the law, the Supreme Court very clearly said that the legislature were entitled to legislate for assisted dying if they so wished. So it is interesting that, like, unlike all the other big social issues in which we've had referendums, this is one where we simply don't need a referendum. And therefore, it's up to the legislative process to address it all on its own.
I presume they could have a referendum, but, you know, given their experience of referendums, there's no such thing as a sure thing in this regard.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's very much a political question, I think. They could choose to put a right to die into the Constitution, but they don't need to. They could go ahead and do this without that and avoid the complexities and the vagaries of a referendum.
How much can we learn from other jurisdictions, Andrea? Because I'm always saying in this programme, we keep on reinventing the wheel when there are models elsewhere that we can look at, critique, and then, you know, take the best of them.
Absolutely. And I think it's one that's really notable about the committee's work is that they really did that. So if you go through the people who presented to the committee, you'll see the leading experts from all over the world on both sides of the debate. So it's really a remarkable lineup of experts. So they talk to people from jurisdictions with legal assisted dying, lots of people from Oregon, for example, very famous regime, people from the Netherlands, people from Belgium. And I think what's really important is to note is that there are really important principle distinctions between those different regimes. So, for example, in Oregon, the only criterion is terminal illness. In the Netherlands, the only criterion is suffering. And obviously the committee, I think, probably has engaged with those varying regimes and is trying to divine a specifically Irish approach to this very complex topic.
The other question that will arise, we talked maybe at the end of people's lives where dementia might be a factor and therefore presumed permission might not be evident to do something like this. What about at the other end where you've got children who are suffering terribly?
Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know what the committee is going to say about this. There are some jurisdictions which allow assisted dying for children. Belgium allows it for a child of any age. The Netherlands allows it above 12. So it's very, very controversial. Children don't enjoy a right to refuse treatment in general. We don't recognise their entitlement to say that they don't want to live anymore against kind of medical advice. So it would be a very significant divergence in the law if we were then to say that children are entitled to access assisted dying.
Given how complex this is, even though the committee has done its deliberations, and given even at the outside, the length of time left in this Dáil, do you think it'll pass before, whatever they put forward, before the end of the Dáil?
I mean, I would be surprised if they could get through the kind of detail they need to, because the core thing with assisted dying is that I think instinctively it can be quite attractive for individual people, but crafting a regime that includes sufficient safeguards is extremely difficult. So I would be surprised if that was to happen very quickly.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much for that legal perspective. Dr. Andrea Mulligan, Assistant Professor of Law at Trinity College Dublin and herself a practicing barrister. Now, Dr. Miriam Colleran, a consultant in palliative medicine, listening to that conversation. Miriam, good morning.
Good morning, Pat, and thank you very much for having me on this morning.
Now, let's talk about your perspective on this. This is a complex area.
Yes.
We should advance perhaps slowly.
Well, I suppose what you, and a key word there is compassion. And as Dr. Mulligan rightly brought up, she brought up about risks and about safeguards, you know. So we want, and you mentioned about all the changes that have happened in our society. We want and we strive to be a compassionate, caring society, as we should be, you know, and that includes persons with advanced and serious illnesses, and to care for them as much as possible and support them. And obviously, autonomy is hugely important. And to us as a Western society, we really value autonomy. But when we're coming to, there's also the balance of, and what jumps to mind, of course, is John Donne, No Man Is an Island. Everything is in the context of autonomy being important, but exactly the societal implications, which was coming across very strongly there when I was listening to Dr. Mulligan. And I would agree entirely. We want to be a compassionate society, just like our other fellow Europeans. And what's jumping to mind to me is the Danish Ethics Committee. They like us, were deliberating discussing in detail about this topic, about whether or not assisted dying, or as some people call euthanasia and assisted suicide, was to be legalised. And they came out with a very strong, comprehensive, detailed report in October. And their conclusion was, and it was 16 out of 17 members of the Danish Ethics Committee, that no safeguards could be put in place that would actually make it totally safe. You know, they came out with very strong concerns about the risk to persons who are vulnerable. And I suppose I am, as you mentioned, I work in palliative care, so I feel very privileged to work with people who have very serious illnesses, progressive illnesses, people who are facing their end of life. And I'm a member of the Irish Palliative Medicine Consultants Association. And the Irish Palliative Medicine Consultants Association is very concerned about any introduction of assisted dying, euthanasia, or assisted suicide. And can I just explain what the difference is? Because
sure.
What the difference is, if that's okay for the listeners. So there are different places introduce different forms of assisted dying. One particular type is like Oregon, that Dr. Mulligan mentioned. What they have is what we could call physician-prescribed assisted dying. So that means that the doctor, essentially the patient requests assisted suicide, assisted dying, and the doctor gives them a prescription and they administer it themselves. So the doctor, the healthcare practitioner, is not directly involved in it, you know. And that's the system that is involved, tends to be involved in some of the places in America, in the US, that have legalized it. Other jurisdictions, like obviously see the Netherlands, which has a very expansive and has very expanded over time, and the Belgium, the Benelux countries, and more recently Canada have a system where they have both euthanasia, and like Canada has euthanasia and assisted suicide. And euthanasia means that the healthcare practitioner in Canada, it's a doctor or a nurse, directly administers the medication to the patient, to the person, and that they die. Now I do want to clarify that this isn't evidence-based medical practice. You know, if we were, say, if we were developing a new cancer drug, you know, or a new antibiotic or a new drug for someone's heart condition, they go through really, really extensive trials to assess toxicity, to make sure we know how the medication is working, the risks. So they go through a very, very extensive trials before something is introduced and before, say, I'd get it from my GP, you know.
Yeah,
or from my husband. No,
there is assisted suicide. I mean, there is in the animal kingdom, obviously, routinely.
Yes.
Dogs are put to sleep, as they put it, and they seem to be put to sleep without discomfort. They're given a sedative first of all, and then they're given something that stops the heart. And you know, for those of us who've witnessed that kind of thing, it appears to be a fairly peaceful parting.
Okay, and I'm going to apologize, and I have to say I am a real dog lover. We have two dogs at home, and they're on my lap the minute I get home from work. But I'll apologize, Pat. I don't want to compare a human being to an animal, if that's okay.
No, but I'm saying that we often use animal testing in developing things.
Okay, sorry, apologies. I see where you're coming from. But I suppose the evidence is, and it's unclear, but it's unclear actually how people die from assisted dying, from assisted suicide and euthanasia. A little bit of the evidence would suggest actually some of the medication that's given actually makes the person actually, this might be distressing for people to hear. I just want to throw a caution about that. The little bit of evidence is that medication can be given that actually stops the person paralytic. It stops the person from moving. That doesn't mean that the person is unresponsive. And then actually there's evidence suggests that actually the medication actually causes very rapid onset heart failure, you know. But again, the evidence is very scanty on when someone, so I feel uncomfortable saying this because the evidence is very scanty on when someone is dying to assisted dying, what the actual mechanism is.
Of
course, they would be given a relaxation medication. Yeah, they would be given relaxation medication.
Obviously, that's a concern about, you know, maybe if it's administered wrongly, if the wrong dose is administered, you have these effects, which would be down to, you know, medical misjudgment, medical error, and if things go wrong. And we've seen, for example, in the United States where they execute people, where in spite of all their science and all their preparation, the executions have gone horribly wrong, giving massive suffering to those whose lives are about to end. But the other question is, you know, the prognosis. How do you know 6 months? How do you know a year?
Actually, what you're saying there is, I think, Pat, is really, really important, you know. And actually, as doctors, as nurses, as clinicians, we can't actually predict like that, you know. So say if John is attending me in outpatients, you know, John is, and the evidence is that we can't predict like that. Now, we can predict better if someone has a prognosis of short months or less, or maybe over a year, but it's actually very poor between about short months and a year. So say if John is coming into me in outpatients and we're having a gentle conversation, and he's and we do these conversations as gently as possible because they're important conversations. It's a person's body. They're entitled to know how long they have, how long we may think they have, but it's only an estimate, you know. Yeah. And for what you're saying is really important, Pat, and I think you've got to one of the hearts of the issue here. So say if John is having the conversation with me and he wants to know how long we think he may have. So what I'll say is, firstly, check with him what he thinks he might have, you know, and I will explain that actually we can only estimate because thankfully there's so many developments that people do better than we expect and live longer than we anticipate. But equally, something unanticipated could happen, like maybe a bad infection or someone could get a clot or something and things not go as well as we hope. So we actually can't predict to 6 months. We can't predict to a year. None of that is actually possible in reality.
The last point I wanted to ask you about is coercive control. because, you know, the pressure being brought on someone to end their lives because maybe they're in pain. Maybe they fill all the criteria, but they really want to hang on in there for as long as they can. And then other people for whom they might be a burden, whether it's visiting or the cost of nursing home care, whatever it might be, is kind of jollying them along and saying, it's about time now, don't you think?
Sure. And that's, I suppose that's actually a big worry for many of us, you know, for many of us. And we know from the evidence, from looking at other countries, and there is an awful lot that can be done. Thankfully, we are, in Ireland, actually is a very progressive society in terms of symptom control. And we want to get things better. We want to keep striving to do better to control symptoms as well as possible. And for however long someone has to live, that time is extremely important. However long they have. But what you're saying is really, really important there. Sadly, we know that the abuse of older persons is an international phenomenon. And unfortunately, it occurs here too. So the evidence, and include Irish recent evidence, shows that about 1 in 6 older persons experiences abuse. That's can be psychological, financial. As people get older, unfortunately, it tends to get more physical, you know, and really sadly, a lot of this tends to be from a family member. And it's really uncomfortable to have to say things like that. We know that as a Western society, we all value our autonomy. We value our independence and we value our autonomy and independence. And there's a risk of societal ableism and of people feeling pressurized. You're exactly right. Unfortunately, as doctors and nurses, we actually, that's actually outside our area. While we check capacity, but checking for coercion is very, very difficult. And it's actually outside our scope of practice.
Well, you know? It won't be outside the scope, hopefully, of those who are drawing up any legislation that might ensue. Dr. Miriam Colloran, consultant in palliative medicine. And before that, Dr. Andrea Mulligan, assistant professor of law at Trinity College in Dublin and herself a practicing barrister. Thank you both very much for illuminating this fairly complex subject.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.